We're looking at Luke chapter 4 today, verses 21 through 30. And we're looking at what is essentially an episode in a much larger narrative. One little occurrence, one little experience that Jesus himself has, and it's him going to his hometown. It's him announcing to them that he is fulfilling the prophecy that was made in Isaiah the prophet. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has called upon me to preach good news. But the reaction he gets is kind of like the good news doesn't sound very good to them. And so we kind of ask the question today, what happens when good news becomes bad news? Or when good news sounds bad to some people, as it does here? You know, some of the episodes that we have in the New Testament is like, well, they're like short stories. They don't necessarily reveal the whole novel and reveal the climax and come to a conclusion in the novel. In other words, they don't resolve conflict. What they do is they sometimes reveal it. And we see here Jesus' work kind of revealing some conflict. Jesus has already announced, as I've mentioned, that the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled in their hearing with his very presence. And there are some questions that arise about the story. So we want to think about, first of all, some questions. We want to think about who believes and who doesn't. And we want to think about why does good news sometimes sound bad to people? Well, what seems to be the point of the story? Maybe that's the first question we can deal with here. It certainly has a lot to do with the reception that he gets by his hometown folks, the people who know him, people that maybe saw him grow up, people that probably could walk around and say, well, we remember you when you were this big. You know, you have people like my, how you've grown type of thing. We remember you when you did such and such. We remember you when you got in trouble and such and such. I don't think they could say that about Jesus, but they know that about us. Hometown people know a lot of different things. They're familiar with you. Now, Matthew chapter 13 and verse 57 gives essentially the same thing that Jesus says here about no prophet is acceptable in his hometown. And I suspect maybe the story goes a little deeper than just familiarity, but that certainly is the essence of the issue here. They're familiar with him, and they can't quite understand how he could be the one to fulfill the prophecy that was mentioned by Isaiah the prophet. Maybe it requires some bigger thing. Maybe it requires some grander scheme of things in their way of thinking that this is too familiar to us. It's always a mystery to me why that happens, but in fact, Jesus says very clearly that that's exactly what happens. We could also ask the question here of Jesus himself, why begin with confrontation? Maybe that's just a question that I would ask. You know, my way of understanding dealing with people is, you know, start with being nice. Start with being friendly. Try to build the bridge. Try to make a relationship and so forth. Jesus does not try to explain himself here. He simply confronts them. He knows what they're thinking. And their words in verse 22, where it says, they all spoke well of him, which is a good start. They marveled, however, at his gracious words that were coming from his mouth. Kind of begin to get a little hint here of, we're not real sure about this. How did he get all this? And then they said, is this not Joseph's son? You know, and there's a very clear implication here that they're just being a little skeptical. Their words betray that. A certain amount of skeptical is present there. And yet, he directs his thoughts right at them. He throws it right back at him. He says, well, you know what I expect you're going to do? You're going to quote me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. I'm not sure why he expects them to use that particular phrase, but maybe it has something to do with they expect him to do something great there in his hometown. But he has a knack, does he not, in various places, especially in Luke, for knowing the thoughts of people. In chapter 5 and verse 22, we read that he says, when Jesus perceived their thoughts, he says, why do you question in your hearts? He knew what was going on. In chapter 6 and verse 8, we have a very similar thing. But, this is the deal with the man with the withered hand. He says, but he knew their thoughts. And he said to the man with the withered man, come here. And he does this numerous times throughout the book of Luke. Luke notes that. He just knows what's going on. He's aware of what their thoughts were. He just has a knack for doing that, but he confronts them over it. Jesus doesn't let it go. I think maybe a better question here is, why are they so angry? I mean, you look at their response. He says, my translation reads, they were filled with wrath. Now that just sounds to me a little more than they were just a little mad. They're filled with wrath. I kind of wonder if there weren't some gnashing of teeth going on here as well. They were so mad. And he says they drove him out of town. They were going to throw him off a cliff. Why does this make him that angry? I mean, does it seem to you that their reaction to this is just sort of kind of over the top angry? More angry than what the situation would warrant? But somehow his words to them are enough that they want to kill him. And so we're kind of left with this, trying to figure out, well, why are they so angry? Well, he says some stories to them that they should have known, and I think they did know. And I think the stories betray something about who believes and who doesn't. What stories, what things demonstrate, what activity demonstrates genuine faith is kind of where Jesus turns the tables here on them. And he gets them to think about that because he brings up two stories. He brings up the story about, first of all, Elijah and the widow of Zarephath. He says in verse 25, but in truth I tell you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, a woman who was a widow. A foreigner who was a widow. And they know that this woman was a foreigner. Now, if you want to go back and check the story, it's in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 17 and 18. And the famine, essentially, is Elijah's fault. I say his fault. He prays to God. It's through him that the famine comes. He is pronouncing judgment upon the people of Israel. And you may remember that this was during a time in Israel's history when was one of the worst administrations of Israel's kingship. It was during the time of Ahab and his wife, Jezebel. There weren't anyone quite as bad as Ahab and Jezebel. And there are some other really, really fascinating stories that illustrate just how bad they were. Elijah is operating and prophesying during their time. It's not a time to be a prophet. I should say, it's not a time to actually feel like you want to be the prophet. You want to be the one swimming against the tide, because that's what, in this case, the prophet has to do. It's kind of no wonder Elijah becomes one of the greatest of the prophets, at least in the memory of Israel. But during the time that he was prophesying, the king considered him to be an enemy of the people. Think about that. Here's a man speaking the word of God, trying to bring them back to God, and he's the enemy. In the minds of the administration, he's the enemy in the minds of most of the people. And he has caused this famine. And when he has himself concern for his food, God sends him out of the country to the land of Tyre and Sidon to a widow. And the story goes that she didn't have much. She knew she was going to die herself because the famine was affecting them as well. And so he goes there and he says, just bring me a little bread. He says, I only got a little bit. He said, just go make it. And when he stays with her, every night, somehow miraculously, there's enough bread and oil for them to eat. I don't know what else they would have had, but bread and water for a number of years is probably better than no food at all. And the fact is, God sent Elijah to that widow. She's a foreigner. God makes the oil replenish daily for a foreigner. Jesus then says, well, how about this guy Naaman the leper? And you can almost hear him say, you guys know about him too, don't you? Sure you do. You know the story. And he says, and there were many lepers in Israel at the time of the prophet Elijah, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian. Why did God go to foreign countries, away from the people of Israel, to work his miraculous healings, to do the kinds of things that God is capable of doing. 2 Kings chapter 5 tells that story. And the story is a rather interesting one because Naaman is a high official in the Syrian court. And he hears about the fact that there is a prophet in Israel from a slave girl. One of his little slaves tells him, you know, if you only go down to Israel and look for this guy Elisha, you can probably get healed. So the story goes, Naaman goes down there, and of course he's told to go dip in the River Jordan, and he's like, why can't I go to one of the big rivers up where I live, you know, and why can't he just come out and just wave his hand over me and make a big splash and make it really dramatic? Instead, I got to go dip in the River Jordan, that muddy hole over on this side of Canaan. And one of his other servants says, well, if he had asked you to do something great, wouldn't you have done that? Why not go do something that's as simple as wash? Yeah, he does. And, of course, he's cleaned. He becomes not a leper anymore. He will not have to remain away from everybody else to keep from contaminating them. It's interesting, when he first goes, he goes to the king of Israel and says, where is the prophet? And the king of Israel gets very mad. He says, what are you coming to me for? You know, and there's a very clear indication here that there is a lack of faith on the part of the Israelite king at this point. By the way, this is well after Ahab. This is in another whole administration. But they're still bad. They're still not faithful to God. They're still worshiping idols. They're still doing all kinds of stuff they shouldn't be doing. And Elisha is operating now as the successor to Elijah. But Elisha heals Naaman. How come none of the other lepers in Israel are healed? Well, the implication here is very clear that they don't have the faith that a foreigner has. A guy from Syria has faith in God, when the Israelites, the people of God themselves, don't. Well, the people in Jesus' hometown, they know what he's trying to say. They got it. They got the message. They know what those stories were. And they kind of knew the implications of them, but they didn't want to think about it applying to them. And that was part of the problem. You see, in both cases, God finds faith in foreigners. People that they thought shouldn't be even incorporated into the blessings of Israel. The people of God, on the other hand, demonstrate faithlessness. And I don't know if it's just something about familiarity that does that, or our expectations. We'll talk about a couple of things in just a minute as to why that happens. It's somewhat mysterious. People have different reasons why they behave the way they do. You remember Jesus actually encountered a man that he was amazed at his faith. He was a centurion, not someone of the people of God, not some of the people of Israel. Somebody from the outside demonstrated more faith than somebody on the inside. A pretty challenging statement, pretty challenging message for Jesus to try to get across. Apparently, very challenging to get across to his own hometown folks. Didn't sit well with them. Well, why does good news sound bad to people? Why did good news, at least to them and to others, sound so bad? Well, you know, the surface of the story is familiarity. And we all maybe know the statement, familiarity breeds contempt. You know, sometimes it seems to. You know, you get to know somebody a little bit and you get to realize, well, this person isn't quite what I thought they were. I think that's a little too much on the surface, you know, to say that that's all that it is here. Was that the case with Elijah and Elisha? You kind of don't get that impression. You know, they just didn't listen to what Elijah and Elisha had to say when they were trying to turn them away from their sins and back to God and away from their idolatries. It was, in fact, faithlessness that characterized the nation during the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. Great prophets, though they may have been, they were great because they stood up and they confronted a very evil culture. Their own people were evil. Many of them did not listen. Many of them did not want to listen. Were these people in Jesus' hometown self-deceived about their own lack of faith? You know, my guess is if you were to ask any one of them individually if they believe, they would have said, sure, I believe. You know, I'm waiting for all the promises of God. I believe Elijah. I believe Moses. We're followers of them. And yet, Jesus seems to see through the lack of repentance in many of them. In Matthew chapter 11, we see this illustrated perhaps fairly clearly. Matthew chapter 11, verses 20 through 24. Jesus says, "Then he began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon," which is, by the way, where the widow of Zarephath lived, "they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it will be more bearable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works had been done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I tell you that it will be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you." Whew. I don't know why these people didn't want to take him out and throw him over a cliff at that point. That's pretty strong language. He's really trying to get them to see something that they're just not seeing. They're blind to. You know, and I think this is as much the general human problem as it is a problem with the people of God. We kind of deceive ourselves. We say we believe or we say certain things and our lifestyle just isn't consistent with it. Or we just fail to want to admit our faults. Think about how many confessions well-known or professional people make that aren't really confessions. I read about one recently that just, it blows my mind when I hear things like this. You may know the rapper, his name is Psy, P-S-Y. He's Korean. You may not know his name, but you may have heard the Gangnam Style dance, whatever it's supposed to be, okay? Maybe you haven't heard it, I don't know. But the fact is, it's very popular. And he's a Korean rapper. He's made a lot of money in America, too, by the way. And apparently when he had some lyrics a number of years ago when some people in Iran, some missionaries were killed in Iran a number of years ago. And he came out with some language about America. And I'm not going to repeat the particular language other than he said to kill them. Kill those Yankees. Kill their daughters, mothers, daughters-in-law, and fathers. Kill them all slowly and painfully. With some of the lyrics in one of his rap songs. Well, you know, somebody confronted him about it. Here's what he said. "I'm deeply sorry for how those lyrics could be interpreted." Is that an apology? Did he say, "I made a mistake"? Basically, he says there, "I'm sorry that somebody could take it the wrong way." It's like, okay, it's their fault for misinterpreting. How can you misinterpret, kill this person, kill that? How can you misinterpret that? He's not taking responsibility for himself. He's blaming those who are saying he said what he said. Hardly an apology. And a lot of people do that. You know, "Well, I'm sorry that you took it the wrong way," or "I'm sorry if you thought I did a certain thing." That's not really coming clean with what you've done, is it? It's kind of our human problem. We don't want to admit that we're sinners. And we talked a little bit this morning. I kind of wonder, you know, if people just don't have the wrong expectations of God. You know, people seem to expect God to do more than God himself says, "This is what I'm going to do." Alice gave me something the other day that I thought was rather interesting. A person who is an avid atheist giving her reasons why she still remains an atheist. And, you know, they really can't come up with anything new as to why they do it. And I'm sorry for the person because I know people go through trials and sufferings and they see family members hurt and die, and they see things happen, and they're using that as, well, you know, that's why I don't believe in God. Well, you know, I'm sorry that those things happen. They happen to all of us in some way or other. And, you know, it's like you expect God to do something about it. That's really what's behind it. That's what was behind Job. Job says, if God will come down here and he'll only talk to me, I'll tell him, you know, that I'm the innocent victim here. You know, and God really doesn't listen to that very well, you know. But it's like, and you see, we expect God to behave in a certain way. We impose on God what we want God to do. And when God doesn't do it our way, we're not happy with that. I think that was going on in the Israelites when they kept complaining in the desert. You know, God's not doing it the way we wanted him to do it. We want somebody to fix things. We want God to fix things. We can't accept sometimes that God won't fix them in our way. C.S. Lewis wrote an article about the young people in Britain back in the 30s and 40s when he was talking about this. And the article was called God in the Dock. The dock was the witness stand in British law. And basically what he was saying is, the young people in Britain today, they've got God on the witness stand. They want God to answer questions for them. They want God to explain himself. And it's no wonder they won't believe, because they have all these expectations of what God is supposed to do. And if God doesn't do it the way I say he does, I'm going to grill him with questions. You know, if God passes our test, then we'll believe. You know, we're all kind of prone to maybe a little bit of that. We certainly wonder, don't we not, why God doesn't do certain things. And yet, there's a real cautionary tale here in this little episode that doesn't really resolve the conflict. It's just a reminder, isn't it, for us. Let us learn the hard lesson that Jesus' hometown had to learn. We must always keep our hearts open to faith, even if it becomes real familiar to us. As people of faith, we must believe, sometimes even against maybe my personal expectations or our personal expectations. God doesn't always act according to our plan. Doesn't mean he's not there. It may mean we're mad at him. You know, sometimes you get a little miffed. Moses got miffed. That's a mild word, I think, to what Moses was feeling. But he had to deal with it. God helped him to deal with it. We are called upon, as we are told in Philippians 2 and verse 14, to work out our own salvation. I want you to notice one of the things that Paul says when he tells them that. Philippians 2, beginning in verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, so now, not only in my presence, but much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you, both to will and to work for his good pleasure. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish, in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation. It's hard sometimes not to grumble and complain, isn't it? Remember the widow. Remember Naaman. Remember the centurion. Imitate their faith. Just keep believing. Hang in there. God's still at work. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, and know that God is still at work in you and among you.